From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ben Cotner and Ryan White's film about the battle to overturn California's same-sex marriage ban is not just about legal strategies. It's about the characters who drew them up and put them into play. As the film points out, not everyone within the gay community thought the strategy would work or that the timing was right. But it now seems clear the effort to fight California's Prop 8 was the beginning of a wave of momentum that is challenging marriage bans all over the country, including here in Utah. Jeff Zarrillo, one of the plaintiffs in the case, points this out in the film.
Proposition 8 hurt. It hurt really bad. It hurts to this day. But it emboldened a movement like I've never seen.
Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. We're talking about The Case Against 8 after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here in Utah, when a federal judge ruled in December that the state's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional, about 1,200 couples rushed to county courthouses. It was an almost identical scene in 2008 in California when the state Supreme Court there ruled same-sex couples had the right to get married. 18,000 couples exchanged vows in the aftermath of that. But as you now know, 6 months later, California voters passed Prop 8. It was a ballot initiative that defined marriage as being between one man and one woman. And in effect, it invalidated all of those marriages. Today in the program, we're talking about a new documentary film that profiles the legal case against Prop 8. In some ways, it's a courtroom drama. It's about the dramatic and surprising wrangling going on behind the scenes. But it's mostly personal. Even the stories about the lawyers are personal. We're talking about the film today as part of our series on documentary film, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's called The Case Against 8. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us today in the program, Ben Cotner and Ryan White. They directed and produced The Case Against 8. Ryan White has directed and produced television and film. Last year, he directed Good Old Frida about Frida Kelly, a longtime secretary and confidant of the Beatles. The Case Against 8 is Cotner's directorial debut. He worked as a film executive for both Paramount Pictures and Open Road Films. And they're joining us today, both of them, from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Ben Cotner and Ryan White, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having us.
I should mention we're screening The Case Against 8 next week as part of our Through the Lens series, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. So I wanted to begin actually with a clip from the film because the setting, and I sort of set this up a little bit, is 2008. You have these contrasting moments, this joy among some Americans that the country had elected its first African-American president, and then there's this realization that in one of the most progressive states in the union, Prop 8 had passed. Let me play a clip from the film because this is Chad Griffin. You'll hear him of the American Foundation for Equal Rights. It's the organization at the heart of the case against 8. You'll also hear one of the plaintiffs, Jeff Zarrillo.
It became clear to us as Obama was giving his acceptance speech, a historic moment in our nation's history, that Proposition 8 in California was going to pass.
And I remember being so drained emotionally because I had been on such a high, and then to feel the lowest of lows, to know that my fellow citizens in California had voted to take away my right to marry.
And all I could think about was the horrific message that would be sent to the thousands upon thousands of young people in California and around the country that they were second-class citizens, and they had been told so by a popular vote of the people.
Ben Cotner and Ryan White, how did you react to all of that? And at what point did you start thinking you wanted to do something about it in terms of a piece of art, create a film?
Well, you know, as gay Californians, it was a big shock to us that Proposition 8 passed. I think a lot of us thought, like you said, that, you know, California is a blue state. You know, we're heading in the right direction here, and people are going to strike this this proposal down. So when it passed, we were surprised, and it wasn't until a few months later that we heard this lawsuit was going to be filed and that there was this really unique pairing of Ted Olson and David Boyce, who had famously squared off against each other in Bush v. Gore, taking on the case, and that really raised the profile, and I think, and that was the hook that drew us into the case. So we approached them about filming, and they were fortunately very receptive to the idea, and sort of let us begin filming some of the early meetings. And then we met the plaintiffs who were chosen for the case, and I think after spending just a little bit of time with them, Ryan and I both realized that this is really the heart of the story, and their journey is really, you know, what we're going to focus on for this film.
You've pointed out that the film isn't about whether gay marriage is right or gay marriage is wrong. You weren't really interested in that part. But when you first started thinking about this, did you think legal strategy? Did you think personal? I mean, obviously it came down to the sort of personal story part. But did you know exactly what you wanted late in those early days?
We began shooting without really some massive vision of a five-year film. So I think it's fair to say we were just kind of flying by the seat of our pants at the beginning and didn't really know what our film was going to become or if we even had a film. I mean, no one knew that this was going to take 5 years. We had no idea that it would make its way to the Supreme Court. So we kind of began documenting the process just to be safe. But as Ben said, I mean, the initial hook to us was that Ted Olson and David Boyce had joined forces. It garnered a lot of press in 2009. They were called the odd couple. You know, Olson was the leading conservative litigator in the country and had won Bush v. Gore and was George Bush's solicitor general and worked in the Reagan administration. He won Citizens United, and David Boyce was his opponent in Bush v. Gore and is, you know, one of the most prolific trial attorneys in the country and is sort of the leading liberal litigator. So we thought that bipartisanship would be a fascinating focus for the film, and we hadn't met the plaintiffs yet. We didn't know, they hadn't been picked yet.
Yeah.
And they were sort of perfect casting. It's sort of the lawsuit casted our movie perfectly for us, because then we ended up with these four amazing characters, and not just them, but their families as well, who play a large part in our film. Chris and Sandy are lesbian mothers who live in Berkeley, California. They have four boys, and Jeff and Paul's families also play a pretty large role in our film. So following those families and what it was like for their personal lives to be the center of this firestorm, something that they had no idea that they were signing up for, became the eventual focus of the final film.
Did it surprise you that that the film turned out to be as much about, maybe not as much about the lawyers as the plaintiffs, but that it was such a personal portrait of, you know, of the legal guys as much as it was of the plaintiffs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was personal for, I think, everyone involved. And I think anyone who was in the courtroom during that trial was moved by the testimony of the plaintiffs, by the expert witness who all came out and talked about some of the harms that were done by laws like Proposition 8. So, you know, I think we wanted to get people to get to know Chris and Sandy and Paul and Jeff. But I think, you know, these lawyers are fascinating guys. They're some of the greatest legal minds in the country. And they have incredible stories themselves. You know, they're warm. Ted Olson, I think, is one of the warmest people I've ever met. He hugs us all the time. You know, it's something that, you know, it was really a pleasure for us to get to know them. And I think we wanted to get that across to the audience so that they could share in that.
There's a moment in the film I want to play a section. This is the really early on, and it's Christine. Is it Shockey?
Shockey.
Yeah. Christine Shockey. She's with the American Foundation for Equal Rights, and she's with Chad Griffin, whom we heard just a moment ago. And they're at dinner. And this idea of Ted Olson comes up because it seems really surprising at first that they would even consider something like this. I mean, as you said, he's a really conservative person. But let's play another clip. This is from the film The Case Against 8.
And while we were talking, a woman came up to the table just to say hello to Michelle. And she said, "What are you talking about?" And Rob recapped what we had been going through. And he said, "You know, we're actually thinking the best way to do this might be to file a court case." And she said, "You know, my former brother-in-law is Ted Olson. And he might be interested."
My reaction was I didn't believe it. Ted Olson had been on the other side of everything I had ever done in my life.
But we all kind of thought, but what if? What if? My gosh, that would change everything. We all knew that he's the most prominent conservative lawyer in America, that he was President Bush's Solicitor General, and he won the most contentious case in front of the United States Supreme Court in our history.
What was the reaction at first? Because this is an important theme in the film. It's important to say that not everyone was entirely on board with the idea of bringing Ted Olson into this story.
I mean, it was shocking. It was shocking to everyone, I think. I mean, you have to remember, in today's climate, it's kind of normal that Republican politicians can be in favor of gay marriage. But at the time, in 2008, when Prop 8 passed, I think virtually the only prominent Republican politician in favor of gay marriage was Dick Cheney, of all people. Yeah. And so when Ted Olson took on this case, it was shocking for everyone. And it was really the game changer. It sort of turned the issue upside down. It stripped party politics away from the very first moment. And so, instead of it being a left and right issue, it became a human rights issue. And I think that's where Ted Olson really sort of shifted. And that's where I think it's allowed, there's a part of our film where we show what's really happened over the 5 years and the changing in public opinion, but also now, for the first time, states started legalizing gay marriage themselves. Our president came out in favor of gay marriage because he wasn't even in favor of gay marriage when this case began. Our vice president did first, I guess.
Yeah.
And then Republican politicians started falling left and right. And so I think Ted Olson deserves a lot of credit for that. And we wanted to bring that into our film, sort of the bravery that it took. I mean, we know that he personally lost a lot of friends and colleagues by doing this, but it's something that he passionately believes in. So it was shocking to Ben and I as filmmakers that he was taking this stance, but we also, and we still disagree with Ted on most political things, probably.
Right.
But we agree with him on this issue, and we fell in love with him right away. And we, as gay Californians, filmmakers aside, as gay Californians, once we met him, we felt, we're in really good hands. This guy isn't just doing this for another feather in the cap. He's doing it because he passionately believes in this.
How do you figure that he does believe that? I mean, what do you think? Do you think you understand what motivates him, personally about this issue?
Well, I think from the beginning, Ryan and I both were sort of like searching for that silver bullet of, oh, does he have a nephew or a cousin or someone in his family that he's gotten to know? Because so often you hear that that's how people sort of change their hearts and minds, is by getting to know people. And, after all the investigating we could do on that issue, all we could find is that he never really opposed same-sex marriage. He actually has always been in favor for equality. The Constitution is very important to Ted. It's a huge part of his life. He spent his career arguing about it in front of the Supreme Court. He's one of the most often people who most often goes in front of the Supreme Court. So I think that, it's something that he would say he's always believed in.
Hmm. Here's another clip. This is Ted Olson in the film, The Case Against Eight.
Marriage is a conservative value. Two people who love one another, who want to come together and live in a stable relationship, to become part of a family and part of a neighborhood and part of our economy. We should want people to come together in marriage.
It brings us to David Boyce, his sort of compadre. They probably don't agree on much else either. David Boyce, this prominent, progressive attorney, brilliant too. And it's what's so interesting about the film is you see the relationship between David and Ted, and it is this deep sense of not just respect, but affection. Describe, if you would, your sense of that relationship between David Boyce and Ted Olson.
Well, Ben and I like to joke that our movie is three love stories. It is the love story of two plaintiffs, and then there's a love story between these two incredible lawyers.
Yeah.
But little did people know that in Bush v. Gore, they formed a very close friendship. David says it in our film that there comes a point in every court case where you're so obsessive that even your loved ones don't want to hear about it anymore, and the only person that will continue talking to you about it is your opponent. And David and Ted both take their cases very seriously. seriously and become obsessed with them. And so they forged this quiet friendship in Bush v. Gore. And they had always wanted to work together on something, but they don't agree on much. You know, they both love wine, and apparently they both support gay marriage. And so they took on this case together. But that relationship was really fun to get to follow for 5 years because they are very different people and they are very different types of lawyers. And so it allowed Ben and I to shoot two different types of lawyering that are both genius, but both very different. And so, you know, Ted Olson is primarily an appellate lawyer. So he is an orator. He can pivot, you know, on a moment's notice. He can turn the hardest question into the most brilliant answer. And that's what we watched for 5 years that he did in the district court and then the appellate court and then ultimately in the Supreme Court. David is a completely different type of lawyer. He's typically a trial attorney. So where his expertise really shined through in this case and in our film was through depositions and cross-examinations, which are highly cinematic, I think. And, you know, they play out like Law and Order, Perry Mason, you know, and you get to watch him eviscerate people, and he can be very, very scathing when he's taking someone on. And so I think their skill sets, not only their politics, but their skill sets as lawyers really complemented each other and sort of probably are the reason that this case was successful.
One thing that strikes you at various points in the film is just how well the team was at challenging Proposition 8, how they had to know the ideas in the case against them. And it does show how prepared they figured they had to be. But there's also these scenes, these sort of mock depositions. The initial scene is Attorney Ted Olson. It's a terrific scene in this kind of mock oral argument before the Supreme Court. And they're really grilling him hard. And in fact, some of the most intense moments in the film are these mock depositions. And you realize how prepared they wanted to be, prepared they wanted the plaintiffs to be. But also how difficult these scenes kind of were, how they took them personally. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that this was a massive operation. There were over 100 attorneys working on this case. And, you know, it was two firms, Ted Olson's firm, Gibson Dunn, and David Boyce's firm, Boyce, Schiller & Flexner. They came together along with the support of the City County of San Francisco, who had had a lot of experience in marriage cases. And they united all of their team. And it was amazing to see how well all of those teams worked together. And everyone had their sort of complementary skills that came together to bring the best case. And for them, it was really once the judge said, and I think it's important also to note that the trial was a surprise for everyone.
Yeah.
People thought that the judge would rule just on briefs and they would move on to the appeals court. And this judge said, you know, I think it's really important for these facts to be discussed in a court of law and have experts come in and talk about what the science is behind all of these issues. So while all this was going on, they were preparing dozens of witnesses that were going to come in and talk about psychology and sociology and economics and all of the factors that went into this case. But at the same time, you had the lawyers preparing the plaintiffs for what they were about to experience because they didn't know that they were going to testify in a federal courtroom when they signed up for this case. And so that was a big deal. And, you know, they really, credit to them, they stepped up to the challenge. And seeing them prepare for those, it was really amazing. And for us, since we weren't able to actually use footage from the trial because the Supreme Court blocked the broadcast of the trial, you know, those prep scenes where they really allowed us to show some of the emotion that ultimately went into their testimony when they were in the courtroom.
It seems like that ruling by the Supreme Court that they wouldn't allow cameras in the courtroom, that seemed to really kind of change the dimensions of your film in some way, because you had to get creative and people would be relying on sort of a dramatic impression of all of this. So in some ways it kind of went to your favor, I guess you could put it that way.
I think it did, yeah. I mean, Ben and I were very ambivalent when that whole issue was going up before the Supreme Court on whether we wanted access to that footage. Because on one hand, access to footage in a courtroom is incredible, right? It's a boon of footage that people wouldn't normally get to see. On the other hand, we had been following this behind the scenes for a year at that point. And any filmmaker could have come in and made a very quick film about that trial itself. And we knew we were in this for the long haul, that we were going to follow it through the Supreme Court. So it did provide us a challenge, and I agree with you. I think it worked out for us in the end because we were presented with the challenge of how do you tell the story. And so our film became more about pulling the curtain back on what goes into these types of prolific lawsuits, because Ben and I had never really seen a film that followed that closely. What goes into a lawsuit from its inception all the way through its Supreme Court, you know, win or loss. And so we wanted to follow that process behind the scenes. And so our film is kind of, you know, pulling the curtain back on that process. Mm. And thank God that the lawyers, you know, because it goes against every bone in a lawyer's body to allow a documentary crew to follow you. It's just not natural for that process. They're so confidential and they're so private. Thank God that they were willing to pull back the curtain for us as well. And also the plaintiffs, because they were going, you know, like Ben said, they didn't know that they were going to go into a courtroom. And so they spent days, grueling days, going through every moment of their life with lawyers, because they knew that they could be cross-examined on the stand, and they didn't know it was going to happen. And so those were highly emotional days for them. They were not fun, and they still they never once asked us to leave with our cameras. So it's a credit to them as well.
There's one moment where Sandy is being deposed by by a lawyer on her team, but is being really difficult about really intense, actually, about something that Sandy had written on her Facebook page. It's kind of this withering questioning, and it sort of shows, and this happens a few times in the film, as I was referring to earlier, it shows really the intensity of that experience, another glimpse that we wouldn't have gotten if you hadn't, you know, been filming all of this.
Yeah, I mean, these four plaintiffs, they're really special. They are, you know, I can't say that they're ordinary, because I think after seeing what they've done and the challenge that they've stepped up to, they're not ordinary people, but they were anonymous people who had day jobs, and they weren't used to this type of thing. So for them, this was an incredibly difficult, challenging thing. Everyone has, you know, parts of their lives that they don't want dissected in a courtroom. And, you know, that scene in particular, it's great because it shows that there was also a certain levity to it. And there was this great humor. I think all of these characters, fortunately for us, ended up being really funny people, too. And, you know, the punchline of the scene is that, you know, they're calling her out on something on her Facebook page where she's, you know, says she's a middle-aged mom with delusions of grandeur, which I think you can understand that, like, that's an ordinary thing in your life that could be taken out of context. And, you know, it's something that anybody could have written just as a joke.
Yeah. This time it's going to be scrutinized by a team of 100 lawyers, which is amazing. And you know what? The other part is extraordinary, and you talk about the process, but what they went through to select these couples, the people's, you know, the people, their names who would be on the lawsuit. It was like vetting a vice presidential candidate. And you mentioned the idea of an ordinary person, and David Boyce says this in the film. He says, you have to have people who are like everybody else and people who are obviously like everybody else. And he says those two things are different things that they have. What does he mean by that?
He meant a huge part of this case from the very beginning was education, right? And they knew that they had to win the court of law, but they had to also win the court of public opinion. Mm. And to do that, they needed people that anyone could relate to. So, you know, they wanted plaintiffs that a middle-aged mom in Kansas who might not support same-sex marriage could relate to. And I think that's where they did perfect casting. And they got, you know, like Ben said, they're not ordinary, but they were regular couples. They all had day jobs. They paid their mortgages. They didn't know that they were going to be on the cover of People magazine, you know, and on the Today Show. They didn't. That's not what they signed up for. And so they wanted people who were just like any average American. And I think they got that with these four plaintiffs.
And they all four, when they were on the stand or being cross-examined in one of these mock depositions, they all said remarkably profound things. And that's another thing that's throughout the film. Here's one. This comes – David Boyce is doing a mock cross-examination of Paul Khatami. He asks him a question that he expects is going to come up in the case. Why not? Why won't he? David Boyce says to Paul, why aren't you and Jeff, why don't you just be content with the fact that California has a domestic partnership law? You know, you have access to these certain, why is marriage so important? Why do you need marriage? Here's this exchange. David Boyce again, cross-examining Paul Khatami in the film, The Case Against Date.
California does allow you to become domestic partners, correct?
Yes.
And you and Mr. Zerillo have not done that, correct?
We have not, correct.
Don't you think that would be a step towards validating your relationship?
I, in fact, think it's the opposite. It is validating the fact that we're separate and unequal. And any time you're dealing with people's civil rights, and the right to get married to me is a civil right, and you say, but there's something that's lacking from there, you've created a second class of citizen, and you feel that way. So by accepting a domestic partnership, we also accept being second class citizens, and that was unacceptable to us.
That's a perfect answer. That really is a great answer.
I love that scene because you get a sense that David is like, thank heavens, these guys are saying the right things. I mean, it's like, yes, these guys say exactly the right things. And that's an important part of the film because, like I said, they all say really touching, profound, articulate things throughout.
Yeah, I mean, I think not only were the lawyers lucky, we were lucky as filmmakers to have such a you know, amazingly articulate people who spoke to truths that I think are very difficult to put into words. I think as gay people sitting and listening to them testify, they were saying things that were true about myself that I didn't even realize about myself. And when I heard them spoken out loud in a courtroom, I was like, you know, as you know, Chris says, it was an aha moment.
Yeah.
Of sort of realizing some of the things and the injustices that we teach ourselves to put up with on a daily basis. And but a really important when it comes to looking at laws like this and evaluating them in a courtroom setting.
We are here with Ben Kottner and Ryan White. They directed and produced The Case Against 8. Next week, Friday evening the 13th, we're going to be screening the film as part of our Through the Lens series with the Utah Film Center. After the film, there is going to be a panel discussion with California plaintiffs Jeff Zerillo and Paul Katami. They'll be with us, as well as Jeff Mejia. He's the legal director for the ACLU here of Utah. The film starts at 7 at the Salt Lake City Library. Seating is very limited. We're trying to do something different this time so we can not deal with the frustration of people not being able to get in. So you're going to need RSVPs in advance to attend, and you can do all of that at radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on documentary film, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next week, next Friday, we're going to be screening The Case Against 8, which is about the federal lawsuit filed to overturn Proposition 8. That's the California law that banned same-sex marriage. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. The filmmakers Ben Kottner and Ryan White are with us to talk about the story they captured. It's about the legal strategy and, of course, these powerful personal stories. We'll give you the details on the screening as we go along. Ben Kottner and Ryan White are joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. There's an important theme in the film about how the LGBT community wasn't entirely on the same page about the best legal strategy or the best way to go about challenging Prop 8. I wanted to play another clip from the film. This is Christine Shockey again of the American Foundation for Equal Rights. And she talks about early on that disagreement about the strategy. Now, keep in mind, again, they've decided they're going to use this really conservative lawyer. And there's a lot of question also about whether or not the timing is right, whether the strategy is right, whether they should ease into it or just go for it. And so they're having this conversation groups, these groups, among them Christine Shockey, and she talks about well, how well it goes, or not how well it doesn't go. This is from the film The Case Against 8.
Most of the gay organizations, most of the progressive groups, fundamentally did not agree with our strategy. They felt like this was too soon. It was years before this should be happening, that public opinion had not changed enough, and the makeup of the Supreme Court was not supportive. In one meeting, actually, one of the lawyers for one of the groups put together a dossier on Ted Olson about all the evil and terrible things he had done over the years and why we couldn't trust him. And they said they would take it to the press. And what we said is, please do go to the press with that dossier because that only helps our case. And actually, at the end of that meeting, they threw the memo at us. That was how bad it got.
Ben and Ryan, talk a little bit about that part of the story, because Chet Griffin in the film talks about the irony that they were spending as much time, at least early in those days, fighting other gay rights groups as much as right-wing groups, which he said was kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's no secret that this case was controversial even amongst LGBT people, and even for Ben and I, you know, we weren't activists. We were filmmakers when we began this film, and that was sort of the murmur, was this could set the movement back by decades, you know. And so we definitely had friends saying, why are you even filming that process when this could set us back? And we were conflicted ourselves, and no one knew at the time whether that would be the right strategy, you know. It was only time could tell that. But it should also be noted, you know, these LGBT groups deserve a lot of credit for the work that was going on before Prop 8.
Yeah.
You know, and Ben grew up in Indiana. I grew up in Georgia, in climates where marriage equality, you know, wasn't in a twinkle in our eye growing up. It just wasn't something that we ever thought would be realized. We didn't think we would ever have that. And there are people that fought for decades before Prop 8 to make that a reality and pave the way for legal teams like Chad and Christina and Ted and David to do this. But it was extremely controversial. I think now it's sort of normal, as you've seen across the country, to challenge a state ban in a federal court. It's happening left and right, and mm-hmm. states are falling left and right, like in Utah. But at the time, that wasn't happening, you know, and Judge Walker, the judge in this case in the federal district court in San Francisco, was the first federal judge ever to strike down a state marriage ban. And so that was a huge moment, I think, in LGBT history when he did that. I encourage everyone to read his opinion, because it's really beautiful. It's 130 pages, and it, you know, it reads like any good novel. Mm-hmm. But that was the first time that happened. And so I think looking back, we see that, you know, it paid off, but at the time it was incredibly risky, and that's something that we sort of examine in the film, and we don't want to take lightly, because it was very conflicted.
I think also there's this, you know, it's important to note that, you know, it's a healthy conversation to have when people, you know, with good hearts disagree about important things. I think, you know, there are so many people fighting in so many different ways, and as much as we can support, you know, as many different paths toward equality as we can, and as filmmakers tell as many stories about those people as we can, that's good for everyone.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Mark Lawrence is with us. He's the founder and director of Restore Our Humanity. It's the group that spearheaded the case Kitchen versus Herbert. That's the challenge to Utah's constitutional amendment that limits marriage to one man and one woman. And Mark Lawrence, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Doug. Thanks.
So I wanted to get a sense, a couple of things, because one of the elements of the film is just how transformational this challenge to Prop 8 was. You yourself have talked about that if without Prop 8, you're not sure it could have happened here in Utah.
Absolutely not. I believe it was Brian was saying when he was talking about Judge Walker's decision. That was what did it for me.
Really?
Yes, yes. A Proposition 8 is entirely responsible for me bringing Restore Humanity forward. And absolutely, if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here now.
What was the clincher? Was it a legal strategy you read in there, or was it kind of a sensibility?
It was that same thing that he said. It was just reading Judge Walker's decision. It was incredible. It was brilliant. And it removed every doubt that I had that, yes, the federal courts were exactly the way to go with this. I realized then at that time that the federal court system were our allies and our friends, because they were talking about the Constitution, and Judge Walker, he defined that.
We should point out that this was also, you also were confronted by questions as to whether or not this was the way to go. No, was this the right legal strategy? You heard that pretty intensely as well.
There are so many parallels here.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. From local organizations here in Utah and national organizations. I reached out to a few national organizations, and I think what they ended up with, putting my emails and letters on their employee cafeteria bulletin boards, look at this. They can't possibly be serious. Yes, so we absolutely went through the same thing.
What made you decide to kind of go for it?
Exactly that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we knew it was the right thing to do.
So are you seeing changes in, again, this is another important theme in the film, this idea that you're seeing these kind of exponential changes, social changes, across this momentum that's moving throughout the country.
It's incredible.
Are you seeing that? I mean, your sense of that in Utah, what is it like?
We have so much more support here in Utah, the population. I don't have the resources to do surveys and opinion polls, but I would sure like to, because the opposition still quotes, this is what the public voted for. And I don't think that if that election, if that vote were held today, I don't think we would see the same results. And I think that's important. And it's happening all over the country.
Yeah. Ben and Ryan, I wanted to hear you on this, not just the particulars of the Utah case, but the effect of Prop 8 on movements like, like here in Utah. How are you reacting to that?
Well, we were really lucky, I think, that we had our world premiere in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year in January. And that was just a couple of weeks after the judge had struck down Utah's ban on same-sex marriage. So there was this great euphoric feeling when we got to Utah and, you know, several hundred, if not thousands of people had been married in Utah. And we had a party where a lot of the people that had been married recently got to come. And that was a great feeling. And we had a screening, one in particular in Salt Lake City, that, you know, it was just great to see how healing it can be when these victories take place, especially in places like Utah, where I think there was a sense of hopelessness. So I think it's great. And, you know, we've seen that around the country now and been to several states. We've been playing in a lot of what are considered red states where same-sex marriage is not legal still. And it's been great to see the reaction of people to the film.
One thing that did not come up, although it's a relevant issue for Utah for obvious reasons, is the role of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Prop 8. One of the, if not the main sort of financial proponent in terms of religious organizations or organizations in general related to Prop 8. Now, Ben and Ryan, your documentary wasn't really about that or really even about the other side. It was sort of more of a focus on the side against, as the title implies. But do you want to say something about the decision you made not to spend more time with that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, Ben and I discussed from the very beginning that we weren't trying to make an advocacy film or a social issue film, which there's a lot of great documentaries that are, and we were setting out to make a character film about this team of people and these unlikely characters that had formed this coalition. But yeah, I mean, it's well known and it's been well covered in other films. Actually, there's a great film called Ate the Mormon Proposition that really examines the money that came from the Mormon Church that helped fuel the passage of Proposition 8. Also the Catholic Church. There was also a lot of talk about African-American turnout during the polls, you know, and voting for Obama, but also voting yes on 8. So that stuff has been well covered in other things. So our film kind of begins where that leaves off and is about the lawsuit against Prop 8. But it should also be noted, you know, our film is also about the court of law. And you can't bring religious arguments into the court of law. And so you see shades of that in our film when we were talking about the messaging that went on in Yes on 8. But for the most part, that wasn't being discussed that much because you can't bring those religious arguments into the courtroom. And so a lot of the messaging that was used in the Yes on 8 campaign about, you know, churches or about, you know, protecting children, protect our children was the tagline of the Yes on 8 campaign. That couldn't be that the proponents of Prop 8 couldn't bring that into the courtroom. And so it's not a major focus of our film.
Yeah. Mark Lawrence, I wanted to get your sense of the Mormon Church's sort of role in all of this. What was sort of the takeaway from your perspective for the LDS Church in that experience? Do you get a sense of that?
Yes. I think that they were probably shocked when they saw the results of what happened. I think that their original attitude, their original plan, was they were going after a very small group of people. And they didn't expect the results they got. It's like they got up to drain the swamp and all of a sudden, where are all these alligators coming from? You know, they didn't expect what happened. And when I look at it, there are people who don't agree with me, but I think they have a lot of responsibility and a lot of that's the reason we're where we are now. They are the ones that brought this into the public discussion. They are the ones that got people talking about it. If you go downtown in Salt Lake right now and you talk to 12 people, ask them what Amendment 3 is, two of them will know. But every one of them will know what Proposition 8 is. And I think that we owe that to the church. They're the ones who got that going.
What's your sense of their sort of public involvement today in this issue? Because, I mean, there's some sense that they had to sort of backpedal a bit or back away from
yes.
all of that.
Absolutely. And I have not heard them make many, many public statements. They've had a few statements in their conferences, and they're still reaffirming their belief that marriage is between one man and one woman. But they have certainly softened their attitude on a lot of things. And their message seems to be more about getting people to start supporting religious liberties now. And they're still going after the political things, which they probably shouldn't be doing, but they are. But they seem to be more interested in protecting the so-called religious rights and religious liberties. And it's like they've – I don't know. I think they're finally coming to the realization that this is what's going to happen now.
That's Mark Lawrence. He's director of Restore Our Humanity, the group responsible for the legal challenge to Utah's Amendment 3. We also have with us Ben Kottner and Ryan White, who directed and produced The Case Against 8, which premieres later this month, we should say, on HBO. We'll give you more details about that as well. We're screening the film next week, next Friday, as part of our Through the Lens series, a partnership with the Utah Film Center, Friday night. That's June 13th, 7 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Library. We're going to have a panel discussion following the film. And that's going to include, by the way, we should mention California plaintiffs Paul Katami and Jeff Zarrillo. Seating is limited. In fact, I think we have something like 120 seats left. So you're going to need to RSVP to attend. Go to our website to get your name on that list. We're at radiowest.kuer.org. Ben and Ryan, stay with us if you would. Mark Lawrence, thanks very much.
Thank you
for being with us. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. We're talking about Ben Kottner and Ryan White's film, The Case Against 8, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival back in January. It's going to be premiering on HBO later this month. We'll give you the details about that. We're going to be screening it on Friday. Again, we'll give you some particulars as we go along. So I wanted to ask Ben Kottner and Ryan White about the... The dimensions of the other side of this case that you do explore, because what starts to happen is, as you point out in the film, is in particular Ted Olson and David Boyce are able to kind of start to dismantle the case that they're making to defend Proposition 8. And there's this moment. Charles Cooper is the lead attorney in this case. For Proposition 8, to defend Proposition 8. And there's this extraordinary moment in this exchange between Judge Walker and I think it's and Charles Cooper. And it's explained in the film by Ted Boutros. He's one of the members of the legal team fighting Proposition 8. And it's this question of what harm. I want to play this moment again from the film, The Case Against 8.
Chuck Cooper was arguing his motion to dismiss the case. And Judge Walker asked him what harm would occur if gay people are allowed to marry. And this was a big issue in the case because that was the argument, that these harms would occur, and there was this silence. And it wasn't 2 seconds or 3 seconds. It was a discernible, lengthy pause. And Chuck finally said, "I don't know. I don't know." And I leaned over to Ted Olson and said, "He just said, I don't know." And Ted Olson said, "I know." We were just stunned because it went to the root of the entire case.
Ben Kottner and Ryan White, explain that. Why is this so important, this idea?
That was a really big moment, I think. When he said that, sort of the reporters in the room stood up and ran out to go file their stories, and that sort of became the headline that, you know, the judge asked, you know, what could you name an example of one of the harms that would be done if Proposition 8 is struck down? And Chuck Cooper said he didn't know, and he repeated that line again, "I don't know." And, you know, later when they were at the Supreme Court, one of the Supreme Court justices asked Chuck Cooper if there were any other rational reasons why you could discriminate against gays and lesbians other than marriage. And he said, "No, I can't think of anything in that regard." And I think that really goes to the heart of why this trial was so important, because when you go into a courtroom and you actually have to look at the facts and not rely on slogans and campaign ads, and you actually look at the the science behind these things, there wasn't a strong argument. And, you know, David Blankenhorn, who was the principal witness on their side, famously changed his mind a couple of years after the trial and publicly said that he now supports same-sex marriage. And he said in that courtroom, we would be, he admitted to David Boyce under cross-examination, that we would be more American the day that we allowed gays and lesbians to marry, and that children of gays and lesbians would be better off if their parents were able to be married. And that's their lead witness. So, and you know, actually, it's been reported since we finished this film, it's been reported that Chuck Cooper is, you know, supportive of his daughter who is marrying another woman. So I think that, you know, those things are one of many factors that probably went into the changing of those two individual minds. But I think that the fact that they were in the courtroom hearing Chris, Sandy, Paul, and Jeff talk about their lives, I think definitely had an influence on them. I'm just speculating, but I would just guess that that was a big part in their evolution on the issue.
It's the Perry Mason moment. That the moment you're talking about, when David Boyce is cross-examining David Blankenhorn, and this is an important part of the film, because I wanted to play another clip here, because Ted Olson describes David Boyce, his cross-examinations, as magic, and you get a sense that you were talking about this earlier, how good David Boyce is at all of this. And he is cross-examining Blankenhorn, who's making this case that marriage is about establishing lines of parenthood. But he really is able to kind of dismantle the point that Blankenhorn makes. And so we'll hear in this clip from David Blankenhorn himself and Ted Olson, who's telling the story about this, as he calls it, this Perry Mason moment.
I'm fairly sure that if I was asked all those same questions again today, I would answer them the same way.
David just sort of took him down his trail, and pretty soon at the end of the thing, Blankenhorn was saying, we would be in this country more American the day that gays and lesbians were allowed to get married. And he said that children in a gay family would be better off if their parents were allowed to get married. So Blankenhorn wound up giving testimony that was better for us than anything we could have possibly asked for.
How important was that? Because you've talked about the fact that in some way it kind of changes the course of the trial and sort of set the stage for the next step.
Yeah, I mean, it was so important that Ted Olson quoted David Blankenhorn as the final sentence in his closing arguments
right.
of the entire trial. He quoted the other side's lead witness. But, I mean, look, that was a very uncomfortable day in the courtroom. I'm very passive and don't like conflict that much, and that was very contentious watching those two go head-to-head, and that went on for hours. You know, it's just a few minutes in our yeah. film, but it went on for hours. But it was a major game-changer. You know, it became a major press piece, too, that David Blankenhorn had what they versioned as had admitted these things on the stand. But Ben and I are so incredibly grateful that David Blankenhorn was willing to take part in our film. And I think that's a major takeaway from the film, too, is that we have to be open to people changing their minds. And you can't just buffoon people for their previous beliefs. And so I think it actually took an immense amount of bravery of David Blankenhorn to come out in favor of gay marriage in such a public way. He did it in a New York Times op-ed. Mm-hmm. So you can't be much more public than that.
Right.
But we're so grateful that he was willing to be in our film, too, because he's sort of the crucial character. He's the only, you know, most of the people in our film are in favor of gay marriage from the beginning. And he's the one who changes his mind. And we sort of use him changing his mind, because I think that was in 2011, 2012 when he did that. And that was really when the tipping point kind of started happening, where you saw public opinion really start to change. And I think he's a prime example of that.
There's a moment, I want to play another section. This comes from day one of the trial. Because it comes back around to what you were saying earlier, that, you know, really it's hard to measure it, but the influence of the testimony of Jeff and Paul and Sandy and Chris had to have been powerful. Here's a moment from the film. David Boyce really asks a few questions. This is day one to Jeff Zarrillo. And you'll get a sense here. You're going to hear Jeff reading from his testimony. This is one of the sort of production values, one of the conceits for the film, as you hear them reading their own testimony, which is surprisingly powerful, I have to say, surprisingly dramatic. But here's another moment. David Boyce again and Jeff Cirillo. And then you're going to hear Paul Katami, Jeff's husband now, from the film Case Against Eight.
I said to him, after just a couple of preliminary questions, why do you want to get married?
The word marriage has special meaning. It's why we're here today. I want to be able to share the joy and the happiness that my parents felt, that my brother felt, my friends, my coworkers, my neighbors, of having the opportunity to be married. He's the love of my life. I love him probably more than I love myself. I would do anything for him. I would put his needs ahead of my own.
I had a reaction that was audible, and that's so unlike me, but I like gasped because the emotion came up so strongly. And I remember people around me kind of looking at me, but it's when he said, I love him more than I love myself. And I gasped because I thought, God, I feel the same way about you.
He helped me live my truth, and I wanted to make sure that I was able to articulate that to the people in that courtroom, and most importantly, to the judge.
I want to ask you this finally. You've both talked about how, you know, this film took 5 years of your lives. And Ryan, you said our lives changed in very different ways since we began the film. I wanted to end with that, your sense of how you've changed.
Well, I mean, like I said earlier, I'm from Georgia and Ben's from Indiana. And so I grew up just thinking that I would never have this, that it wasn't for people like me. And if a Proposition 8 passed today, when it passed in 2008, it felt kind of normal. Like, of course it passes. These always pass. They had never not passed. If Proposition 8 passed today, it would feel totally abnormal to me. And that's just 5 years ago. And so I think that's my biggest takeaway from having worked on this film was how quickly things can move when things are in action. And the idea that, you know, I'm an out gay filmmaker, that I'm even on the radio now talking as an out gay filmmaker, and I live in a state where I can get married if I choose to, I would have never thought that was possible 5 years ago. So that's sort of my greatest takeaway from this experience.
You know, this was such a joyful experience for us. Being in that trial, I think, even if we weren't making a film, I would have loved to be there. It was sort of sitting ringside at sort of my own history, the history of a group of people that I long to unfolding. And to see, like Ryan said, how far we've come, and that this ended in one of the most joyful days of my life with Paul and Jeff and Chris and Sandy getting married, and we were lucky enough to be there and to see what that meant to them and the joy that it brings to people's lives. I think if people see that, it's really hard to argue that this is something that we should deny anyone. And as filmmakers, it was just such a joy to be able to witness that and to share it with the world.
It's Ben Kottner and Ryan White. They directed and produced The Case Against Eight, which premieres later this month on HBO. We have details about that on our website. We're screening it next week as part of our Through the Lens with the Utah Film Center, Friday night, June 13th, 7 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Library. There's a panel discussion following the film, which is going to include Paul and Jeff. And you have to RSVP to attend, so go to our website to get your name on the list, radiowest.kuer.org. Ben Kottner and Ryan White, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.